Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today from my very favorite city of London is Victoria Usher. Victoria is the founder and CEO of Ginger May. They are a world-class PR, communications, and so much more firm headquartered over there, but I know you have offices here, I think in Germany as well. It's a really interesting story. We've had a lot of your clients on Great Minds over the years, Victoria, and I'm thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. We had sort of a chance meeting as Advertising Week Europe was winding down at 180 back a few months ago, and I sort of stuck in my head, oh, you should follow up with Victoria. She would be a great guest. So as we start to wind down Great Minds, thrilled to have you here with us today. So first and foremost, thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Pleasure to be here. And I have to say, it was watching Take That, and you weren't like roaring on the boys on stage, were you? You were standing passively back in with all the mature people in the back row.
Well, it was great. Ruth did a wonderful job with them. And we love that partnership we have with YMU. That's a great one. So, Victoria, there's a lot of places to start with you, but where I'd like to start is an interesting area. And here in the U.S., you know, we have such a narrow view and such a non-global view. And I worry about that. We are part of a global community. Right now going on in Russia is a meeting of the BRICS nations, which unites a number of nations, but really starts with Russia, China, and India as probably the most important player. South Africa is part of the mix, and it represents about 35 some odd percent of the global economy. And I think very wisely, led by Putin, they are working on sort of a counterweight to the West and to the G20. And I know way back when you started working as a research assistant for Michael Spicer as an MP, and did a lot of research and wrote a lot of speeches and talked a lot about important issues around European policy in the EU. So I'd love to start in a heady, unexpected area and go back to those early days as a research assistant, give or take 25 years ago, and get your take on sort of the current state of geopolitics, where I feel here in my country, in the United States, that we have a terribly insular view to our detriment.
It's a scary time in the world and a fascinating time right now in 2024. And you know, being European, being based in the UK, we are just that much closer to issues that are going on, like Israel, like Russia. So I think that we are probably more aware. We're probably more aware from a geographical point of view. I know I have friends in the US that are worried about us when we go to Turkey, and they say, oh my God, you need to be really careful. And we're like, well, it's quite a way away from a lot of the conflict. But it does feel sometimes like we're at that center point almost in the UK. And yeah, it's scary because when you go across Asia, for example, it's fascinating. I travel to India quite a lot, and you speak to people in India, and they are very much siding with Russia and China. You know, the world is split in two, and it's we don't really hear that much in terms of that narrative and how much of Southeast Asia is actually having so much investment in it from places like China. So I traveled around Cambodia, Vietnam. The place is thriving. There's cranes everywhere. There's buildings everywhere, investment. It's all coming through from China. And they are really politically so influential in that region. And I had no idea. I came out of Cambodia where there are Range Rovers, top of the range Range Rovers, driving around, so much money in that country that I thought was a hugely impoverished country. And it's all coming from those states. So it is fascinating to see that. I mean, I was unaware of that, given that I am politically very interested, doing, you know, having done a degree in politics, having worked in central government, the way that these things are speeding up, and we are focused so much on the micro here. So the governments are focusing on these small macro issues. But the world is actually split in two, and this is all happening without a lot of us actually seeing what's actually happening. For example, with this Asian continent, with the countries like Thailand, Thailand and all the countries to the east of that, where the Chinese influence is coming down.
I don't know what it is. I've never been in one, but most airports have what they call like a mobile or a cell phone parking lot. I don't know who goes and parks and sits in those. But I feel like in America that we are sitting in the cell phone parking lot arguing with each other, and the rest of the world is, on the runway taking off and moving forward and much faster than we are. And forward is not necessarily forward the way we define forward, but they are working together. They are building alliances. The two most powerful economies in the world now, arguably going forward, are China and India. India now the most populous nation in the world. And we're arguing with each other. You've had your challenges in the UK post-Brexit. Not as severe, I think, as what's going on right here. That level of divisiveness that we have here, you have some of that. But I think we're really missing the boat here, and a lot of our wounds are self-inflicted.
Well, I can tell you that I think there's going to be a real challenge in the next 20 to 40 years in terms of just being the numbers that are coming out with, for example, if you take the sector that I work in, which is technology, the investment that's going into training people in technology in places like that have huge, huge populations, huge China, as you point out, India, the numbers that are coming out of that are just going to swamp, the UK, Europe, the West, just by sheer numbers, because they are just bigger than us. So that's something I talk to my kids about that. I talk about the need for investment in technology training because we are only getting more technological as a world. So we need to be ahead in that race. And that's what I find very frightening when I see governments just not even looking. I mean, they're looking, but are they really looking at the numbers that are coming out as populations are growing? If, for argument's sake, 1% of the population in India are engineers or they're trained in engineering and technology, they're going to be outnumbering us by hundreds of thousands of times. So, and they're just going to have the ability and the strength and the breadth to be able to just deal with these technological innovations that we're going to see coming up in a much smarter way than us. So that's just one thing that I can see that we're really going to be out bust. We're going to be busted on. They're just going to trounce us on it.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And going back to that notion of, what you see with the Chinese in particular investing around the world. Years ago, and we try to go, once every year or so, there's a wonderful place called GoldenEye in Jamaica. And GoldenEye was actually Ian Fleming's home. It's where he wrote all of the 13 original Bond novels, and it's now owned by Chris Blackwell, the founder of Island Records. And it's a very special, little jewel of a place to go on holiday, very private, no one bothers you. People like Keith Richards and a lot of other folks, who don't want to be bothered go there. And we did a trip one year. My wife and I went to Kingston, and we went to Bob Marley's home, and we went to Trenchtown, and we went to Tuff Gong Records. And the drive there was about 2 hours through a very windy, country road. And our guide at the end of the day said, "Oh, do you want me to take the highway to go back?" And I said, "Oh, I didn't know there was a highway." And he said, "Yeah, there's a highway." I said, "Is it faster?" He says, "Yeah, it's about a half hour faster, but you have to pay the toll." And it was some nominal sum of money. So I said, "Sure, take the highway." And we get on this beautiful 8-lane highway, and there's nobody on it. And I said to him, "How did this get here?" And he said, "Oh, the Chinese built it. And they are investing real money in infrastructure, embedding themselves into economies all over the world. We don't do any of that. And that is really going to come back and hurt us going forward."
100%. This is exactly what I saw with my own eyes in Southeast Asia. They're building hotels, they're building housing, they're injecting money into these countries, and it's just politically, you can see what's going to happen, the influence in the next 20 to 30 years, and how they're going to become increasingly and incredibly powerful. And to your point, just leading back to the original point you made about a lot of the work that I did in the House of Commons when I first worked there, I was working in the very early anti-European movement, not because I believed in that, but because you don't turn down an opportunity like that to work with influential individuals who can help you with your career. But looking at that very early state when it was very anti-European, they were looking at the policies, looking to see how they could, you know, start building a narrative. They would start building an argument around how to break up the European Union and their ideology around this. This is, you know, you're talking about the big macro issues here and the world issues. And this is the challenge, which, you know, you're alluding to, which is we're getting stuck on, we're not looking at it as a whole. We're not looking at what the world's going to become in 50 years' time, which is where I get really concerned. And when we start arguing about ideology, which is what we get, you know, this is what's happening at the moment in the election in the US, you know, small micro levels that we're just getting our populations to focus inwards on themselves and inwards on their small micro issues. And of course, there are issues that are very important. I don't want to take away from cost of living and all of those important points that are, you know, keeping people up, a lot of people up at night. But there is a huge, huge world issue here that we also need to be looking outwards and paying a lot of attention to. And we saw that with, you know, when we left the European Union and the UK in 2016, I think it was a terrible decision. It's really weakened us. You know, we saw that with, it was interesting to see how Putin made his move into the EU, you know, and I think he thought that the EU would be a lot weaker than it was. What I found really comforting was that all of those countries all came together collaboratively within kind of 24 hours when he made his advances into Ukraine. You know, there was an immediate, literally, line of countries just saying, no, this is inappropriate. So he hadn't made as much of an impact, I think, with the inroads he'd made with like the UK coming out of the EU. But it's a real shame because it's going to take us years to kind of, well, it's going to be years more of fighting to kind of get back in, and parties disagreeing on these issues, while all the while, as you say, the big powers are making these kind of silent gains on us and weakening us gradually in exactly the way you've just outlined.
Yeah, and we'll see how it goes in our election. But, you know, I think it's not a lock that the United States' historic support of NATO will continue. And that's a big problem. And, you know, there's a real lack of understanding in this country on the whole of our role in the global economy. And that cat's not going back in the bag. You know, it's no longer just about, you know, what happens here. It's not about from Maine to San Diego, you know, it's about from San Diego to Singapore, to Senegal, you know, you name it. We are part of a global economy, and that is critical not only for business, but for culture, for our own future security, our future of energy, you know, which, you know, I've lots of things to worry about. Oh boy, Victoria, this is a mess. All right, we better move to a lighter subject before this show. We'll both need a therapist in the middle of this record. So somewhere along the line, you make a decision to go into communications. And you've sort of seen it from both sides as a founder of Ginger May, but you also had a relatively senior position at a young age with Cinevate at a time when they were sold and became part of the global Dentsu family. So I'd love to go back to Cinevate and talk about what you learned there and that experience that helped plant those early seeds for what, you know, years later would become Ginger May.
So after I was in politics, deciding whether or not I wanted a career in this, and I realized I'd left it too late. So if you're going into a political career, starting it after your degree, you've had it. You know, I didn't realize that actually these network the network for politics starts way earlier, and it starts at uni. So that really wasn't an option for me unless I needed to, unless I was prepared to work for 20 years just to try and infiltrate all of the networks. And I had a friend who was in marketing, and he was working at a publisher actually, and what he talked about was absolutely fascinating. And he was talking about, he was in the data team working, he was the marketing team working with a lot of data. It's like, yeah, that sounds really cool, at knowing nothing about it. And I landed a job about 6 months ago, 6 months later, at a medium-sized independent data business. And I, yeah, just immersed myself in the world of data. It was market research, insight, data, you know, making predictions for marketeers. And it was fascinating. It was also incredibly hardcore because I was running the programs and I was also coding. So it was my first entry into anything that it required such intense periods of time. Just, and I'm not someone who can sit just working on one thing for 5 hours. I'm sort of quite, I wouldn't say I've got a low attention span, but I do need variety. I like to per personally, I don't know about you, Matt, but I like to have five or six things on my computer at any one time. And I, as soon as I get bored with one, I go on to the other. So I kind of just segment, that's just the way I know how my mind works now. I didn't know it then. I just knew that it was incredibly intense looking at one set of data, of data tables for like 2 weeks at a time and pulling out and extracting all the information. However, what that did was it gave me the most incredible start in terms of understanding audiences, which is now what I do. I look at audiences and segmentation and making sure we're talking to the right audiences. So at that time, it was very much looking at huge data sets, you know, tens of thousands of people, and you know, working for companies like P&G, Levi's, you know, a lot of the top brands around the world. So I did that for a few years, but I have to say it didn't excite me. It didn't push my buttons. But I was like, okay, well, this might just be what work is. Maybe just work isn't that exciting. But I had a fantastic boss called Michelle Norman, who I'm actually working with again now. She's actually a non-exec director. And she could see that actually probably my true love was in communications. And she actually offered me the job and said, would you like to go across? Because you understand what we do as a business, you're deep in the data, but would you like to go and try your hand at marketing? And I literally bit her arm off. I was like, fantastic, this does sound really exciting. So I managed to find my feet. I learned on the job. So this was the only thing. It didn't give me a lot of confidence because I had nobody to follow. So I was literally making it up. How do you become a marketing manager for a company? I did loads of reading, a lot of research, and it was successful. We did really well. And actually the company was then acquired by Aegis Dentsu, and I was the person that Aegis Dentsu, that the representative from them, actually I first met them, and I was the first person they ever met at a trade show, and kind of sold them the business. And then they came in and met Michelle, and the rest was history because we were then sold. And I saw this huge opportunity, and this is really interesting, right? Because a lot of people that find themselves in a position where their business has been acquired, I see they tend to move in one of two ways. So a lot of people are very pissed off. Actually, my company's been bought, this really nice business that I've worked in, where I've developed relationships and I bought into that brand. It's now been bought by this bigger company. So I'm going to be a little bit annoyed, quite annoyed. I'm going to push back on people. I'm going to tell them how I feel, that I'm really irritated this happened and I don't really agree with it. And it's interesting because those people tend to find themselves being exited from the business within, you know, a year or so of going in because they're just not behind the management. And I will advise, when I see that happening, I will say to people, you know, this is going to be what's happening, because when you've got companies being smashed together, as it was with Aegis Dentsu at the time, they're looking for, they want to lose people. So you're going to be first in the firing line. So I know it's annoying, but you actually need to suck it up or leave of your own volition, because you will find yourself in a redundancy round. So that's something now, as a business owner, I give that advice quite a lot. I wasn't in that camp. I saw it as a massive opportunity, which is actually for a lot of people what these acquisitions are, a massive opportunity, because you've gone from a medium-sized pond, which was great, but I wanted to develop my career and I knew exactly what I wanted. I was like, I want the role of European Marketing Director, and I want to be in charge of all of these businesses that are part of the Aegis Dentsu network, and I want to get there in a year and a half. So I set myself a target and basically influenced everybody I could in the business, knowing where I wanted to get to. And I did do it within about a year and a half. So I did work my ass off though. So, and it's very interesting being part of an acquisition, because we work with companies all the time now that are acquired. So I do have that firsthand experience, and I can see how it can go very badly wrong for some people. Or in my case, it was probably one of the biggest benefits that I've ever had in terms of an opportunity to develop my career. And then when I was at Dentsu, I was part of the M&A team. So I was part of the team that was bringing companies in. So again, seeing all of that journey that those founders have found themselves on, they're selling to the company. I would see them before and I would see them afterwards. And I'd often see them 3 years down the line, broken individuals, many of them that hadn't had the experience they thought they were going to have.
All right. So there's lots of ways we can go off of that. And I'm going to pick two, and you can pick which one we tackle first. So one is, you mentioned coding. And I know that part of the interesting confluence of things that led to the founding of Ginger May is a marriage of marketing skills, typically that you would find with a chief marketing officer, and then data and analytics. And I'm going to guess that that coding, the data analytics side, that a healthy bit of that comes from you. Talk about that part of you. I am not at all technologically savvy. I had to moderate something during Advertising Week that was pretty lengthy on generative AI and Web3, areas I am ill-equipped to lead a conversation about, but that seems to be part of your DNA. The other question, which we'll tackle afterwards, just to give you a little time to think, is that journey from being part of a big company, in this case, a big global company, to being a founder is a very big leap and requires a very different constitution. When you're part of a big company, in the most simple terms, you know where that paycheck's coming every 2 weeks. When you are the founder of a new company, you're the last one to get paid. So let's talk about either of those. You can pick the order.
I mean, I'm happy to, we'll talk, we can take both. I can do short answers. Stop me if I go on. It's very unique to have somebody in communications, I think, that has been through the journey that I've had with data and coding. And I found it difficult because I'm more of a communicator. I'm more of a PR person. I'm the person in the room that, this is very unusual for me to be talking. I'm the person listening. So, and assessing and sort of judging how the message needs to be put across. So it's a very different side, left side, right side brain that's required within this, within any task that requires data. You know, now I can see why it's been so beneficial. At the time, it's almost like it feels very fortuitous. It's like the journey I had to where we are today, it couldn't have been more perfectly crafted, actually. You know, at the time when I was doing data, it didn't feel like a natural fit. But of course, now I understand where it fits beautifully with what we do. And you're absolutely right when you say it's a marriage of marketing and data. I understand intuitively people that are in the data space, because I sat with them, I was one of them. And they have a very different approach to thinking. So I can think like them, I understand what they need, I understand how to speak to them, but I can also speak to marketing and salespeople. So it's two very, very different approaches. And I tend to find that the data people are the introverts. They're much more introverted. They love getting into their data, into the weeds. So, you know, from a communications point of view, we're normally pulling them out of the weeds and trying to simplify by talking in language that they're going to feel very comfortable and safe in, where they know they can own it and understand it, and it's not going to be devalued and simplified too much so you lose the essence of it. So it's more of that narrative that you're helping them to understand. So, you know, typically CEOs we'll be dealing with will be the kind of in DISC profiling, which is personality profiling. They're the red blue, which is they're very driven, but they're also very introverted, and they want detail. They talk and think in terms of detail. So you have to give them a lot of detail to feel very comfortable, and then they will relax with you. But you always have to set it within that context, and they need to understand that you're not going to de-intellectualize what they're doing. And then you get the more sales-focused oriented CEOs, where they want the big picture and they want it in three bullet points, no more, and you've got 3 minutes to kind of give it to them. So, working with those types of people, you can switch quite easily between. So as a business, we're used to dealing with, clients' data, we produce data, we work with companies that produce data, and then we can then craft a narrative around that data that would be something they could write themselves. In fact, we would probably write it better, actually, because we understand it. We don't just understand what the journalists need and the report and the other key stakeholders that are involved in it, but we also understand it from the basis of like a data analyst, and making sure that data is absolutely accurate and it is definitely saying what it needs to say. So we can do all that part. I don't think there's any other business in the I'd be surprised if there's another business in the world that can do that. And it's literally just because of the background that I come from.
I love that answer, and really gives you, I would think, a bit of a competitive edge in the marketplace.
It does, because I think a lot of people will say they understand data and they just don't. So you're having to link together a lot of different departments to get to the same, to get to an output. Whereas with us, it sits with one, and I'm a very hands-on CEO. I mean, my team will sometimes get frustrated with me, but I love, if we've got a client that's doing something around data, I will take a look at it personally myself and tweak it and rewrite it, even if it's a questionnaire, or I'll look at the data and I'll move things around, just because, 10 minutes of me just looking at it will just, we talk about it as kind of it's the fairy dust. You can just add that, it's that added value that would take somebody weeks to actually get to, just because I've been doing it for so many years and I understand what the client needs to get out of that. So it's again, and it's something I enjoy. So I really don't mind doing it. I really quite I'm pleased to see when they have a really good output and really good, interesting data, because there's so much data out there in the marketplace. So it's stuff that really stands out. That's what's cool.
Well, God bless you. I still can't do long division, so amazing. The only way I can do it is to reverse engineer and multiply to try to get to whatever that answer might be. All right, what we're talking about here is tangible. This is sort of a set of skills, a body of knowledge that you have that you leverage successfully to grow Ginger May, to deliver for your clients. I want to talk a little later about client retention, where Ginger May really excels, impressively so. But let's talk about the intangible and the decision to go from the comfort and safety of being part of a big company. And I know you spent some time at Westgate before you launched Ginger May, but talk about that decision. That's a big one. It's a big leap. I'm sort of a serial entrepreneur. I've got sort of the constitution for it. Not everybody does. I'd love to talk about that journey for you.
So the reason you've asked me that question is because you've done it yourself and you know exactly how it feels. Because most people go, yeah, I can set up as a company. But you're right. I mean, everything you've talked about in the last half an hour or so, you can see those little points where you're talking about paychecks, it's the risk. It's a big undertaking setting up your own business, because you don't know when you don't know if you're going to get paid or when you're going to get paid. And to your point, you are the last one to get paid. So when I first set up, I remember we expanded hugely, and we've had months where I've not taken a paycheck, because of cash flow, you're building cash flow up. So that has to be the priority. You're paying suppliers, you're paying your staff. It's not just, oh, I've got to wait 2 weeks. It can be months and months and months, and you've got to have the stomach to do that. And it was, look, it was a huge leap. It was something I've sort of fantasized about. I was always like, oh, wouldn't it be incredible? But I didn't actually have the balls. I didn't think I had the balls to do it, if I'm brutally honest. People use the word entrepreneur, it's ubiquitous. Everybody's entrepreneur this, and it's really entrepreneur or business owner. It's a much bigger undertaking. It's an incredibly lonely journey that nobody understands unless they've actually ever done it. It's a bit like when people say, yeah, I know what kids having kids are like, because you know, my sister's got kids. I'm like, you don't know what having kids is like because you haven't lived and breathed it. So unless you've actually done it, you do not know the sleepless nights, the cold sweats, the how am I going to pay the bills that you get, you know, in the early days trying to set it up, and the confidence because you're just learning all the time and constantly pushing against your comfort zone. So you find yourself out of your comfort zone multiple times on a daily basis, particularly at the beginning. And it's only when you start getting into your rhythm that you realize that actually being out of your comfort zone is probably something you thrive on. And I bet you do, Matt. I bet you thrive being out of your comfort zone, being hit with kind of new issues, new challenges and problems. But yeah, you're right. I came through a big organization. I joined a small family-run PR and communications and design agency. I just had a child, so Dentsu wasn't going to suit my needs. Essentially, they told me they wanted me to move to the Netherlands and be based out there. And of course, I couldn't do that with a young child. So I jumped ship, went to this small agency, and I'd never done PR before, or communications or design as a being an agency. So I'd only ever done it in-house. It's a very different operation. And not only that, because I went in as managing director, I was running a business for the first time, and the owner literally just gave the business to me and just said, go and figure it out. So I was sitting at night trying to work out VAT returns, trying to sort out things with the accountant. Again, no help at all. But in many ways, I've realized that's actually the way I like it because I just learned faster doing that. So it was when I went to the marketing role, I had to find it out myself. I did the same thing with this business. So I figured it out. And essentially, I took it from we had four people in the PR team, and I took it to 25 within about 2.5 years. So I grew it. There were challenges, a lot of challenges. I learned masses. I actually fell pregnant with my second daughter, and I was told by the owner that if I didn't return within 3 weeks of her being born, that I would lose my job, which was obviously completely illegal. But it was said verbally, always without, you know, I had no way to prove it against, you know, her word against mine. And it was shocking. I couldn't believe it. I'm the most incredibly loyal person. I actually make a great employee. I really am. You know, I love working for other people. It's kind of, that's why I love working with clients, because you are kind of working with them, and we see it very much as a partnership. But I stayed at my first business, Dentsu, Synovate Dentsu, for 14 years. But went to this other business and stayed there and would have stayed. I mean, they had offered me a partnership, but this issue came up where basically I went into labor. I worked a working day. On my last day, I went to labor that night, had my daughter, and I was back in the office 3 weeks later. And I wasn't really in a state. I don't know whether you've got kids, Matt, but I wasn't in a state to be back at work. Right. I mean, I was just, you know, I didn't feel like I was even on the planet. I was so hormonal. But I did it because I'm fairly hardworking, and I couldn't lose. And to be frank, I couldn't lose my job. I couldn't afford to. I was paying a mortgage. So I did it. But the experience was just dreadful, and it wasn't a great experience going back after that. And I had no choice to set Ginger May up. And that's the whole truth. So I'm not going to pretend to have, you know, bravado and this kind of vision, and I had a business plan. I was forced into doing it because I had two young kids, quite frankly, a mortgage to pay, bills to pay, and had a very difficult situation with a resentful boss at work who resented the fact I'd actually taken 3 weeks out for maternity leave and was then punishing me when I came back. It's such a common story. I mean, I hear it every day. It happens all the time. Thankfully, now it's, you know, people can make it a little bit more public. Back then, the only option I had is to find another job and to leave and to make it as smooth as possible when I left. So I was essentially juggling a full-time job as a managing director of an agency, and then trying to set up a business in my evenings and weekends. And I had two small kids. So I've never worked as hard. It was tough, but I did it. So I think it was the September I set the business up. Or set up the brand, and then by the December we had first client, and I managed to resign, and then I started Ginger May. And to be honest with you, started it, I was a consultant with two clients, but that was all I needed. That was all I needed, Matt, just two clients, and that paid the bills.
I do have kids, but the journey of a woman is very different than the journey of a man. And I think you hit on it that culture has gotten better at understanding, what the needs of a professional woman are after having children. I think we have a long way to go there. But, give or take 15 some odd years ago, I think we can fairly still call that the dark ages of how businesses, in particular male-led businesses, treat women who have children.
Well, this was a female-led business.
Really,
So
even
you're
worse,
right.
even
Yeah,
worse.
100%. And I think with men, look, I can't, there's so many, they're all different, all the cases that actually happen. And it's just a disappointment because actually working parents, dads and mums, are the most incredibly loyal people that you can find. If you give them flexibility, they repay you. They repay you in bounds. I mean, honestly, we've got working parents in our business and they bend over backwards to help us and we bend over backwards to help them. You don't need to give them it, they need that, just that flexibility. And if you can give them that, they know how important that is. So they own their hours and their lives. And this business didn't see that. And it's such a shame because I would probably be there now. But again, with a lot of situations like that, where you're hit with something, a curveball, and it was probably the biggest curveball of my life up until that point, and it was miserable. I mean, I was so unhappy with conflicting pulls, which is what you find. I had this conflicting pull from home, very, very young child, 10-week-old baby, when it got really, really bad. The need to make money, being completely candid, and that is the harsh reality. I didn't have a wealthy husband in the city. I was an equal bill payer, so I needed to make my contribution. And then my desire to want a career as well. I just because I've had a baby that, my brain did not exit my body at the same time as the child, I still wanted to be intellectually stimulated and I still wanted to continue my career that I'd worked very, very hard at. And so the and I am, no different from many women I know. So it was a real turning point for me, and it really opened my eyes as to what could be done within the law. Because obviously, what was said to me about coming back up with only 3 weeks, that was not legal. But actually, unless I had the proof, I couldn't do anything about it. But I was being pushed out. But actually, best thing that ever happened to me, best thing ever, because I turned it round, and I wouldn't be here today without that. It's just that you have to push out really hard and against your comfort zone persistently, because I could have joined another agency, but my concern was I could find myself in a worse situation. 5 days a week, I couldn't even work part time. The only option I had was to set up myself and to set my own rules, and that was what was needed. I knew what I needed. I just couldn't find it in another company, so I had to create it myself.
What a story, and one which is still very much being written. But you're now 15 years in. You start off with two consulting clients. All you need is one to be in business. You had two. Talk about, as you reflect now on the journey of Ginger May, what has surprised you? What has gone sort of as you hoped it would? And I imagine there are some things that have happened along the way that you never could have imagined, both good and bad.
Gosh, things that haven't gone well. I mean, oh my goodness, I've made so many mistakes on the way. And I wish I'd got a really strong non-exec director from the beginning to help me to go on that journey. And I could give you 100 examples, but our approach to stuff, it's probably more to do with people, actually. I think we always had our approach to clients pretty much nailed down, and that was my first ever business that did that. So I always knew what I was doing with clients. So that has just really evolved, but we never had any major issues. Michelle Norman, who's my non-exec director now, taught me brilliantly from day one. It's client first, you need to think client first. It's all about giving exceptional delivery, always making their lives easier, even if that's just giving them every answer so they have everything on the email you're sending them. They don't have to refer to anything else, just silly things like that. Thinking through every single point so you've just given them everything they need. So that I was really comfortable with, and that's been at the core of Ginger May in terms of how we've developed. But it's the running the business is I was just trying to make it up like I've done with everything else. But my God, I mean, if somebody, if I could go back now 15 years, the time I could have saved, if I'd have actually talked to people that have been on the same journey, and you get there in the end. So you do get in there in the end, right? And you've probably had the same thing. You get there, it's a bit painful. It takes up quite a lot of your evenings and weekends making kind of errors and mistakes. And I think it's probably mostly around people and dealing with building a team and how you build that culture out. So now, I can certainly say what we've ended up with now is a very, we're a very culture-driven business. We do a lot of coaching. That's been an absolute game changer for us in terms of dealing with problems with it internally, coaching people into kind of seeing their own solutions to it. That was something I could have done with, 10 years ago, to be honest with you, that kind of understanding. And just, I think, yeah, having somebody standing by my side to go on the journey, because it's been me the whole way. I'm the only owner. I've had nobody else to really talk to about business. I did from probably 4 years ago have a network of other CEOs. But I would say if anybody else is starting up a business, that's the one thing I would say is make sure you have a mentor, make sure you're surrounding yourself by people that have been on that journey or on that journey, because you can share best practice and it will just shortcut a whole load of pain for you. I mean, it's fun, don't get me wrong, I wouldn't do it any other way, but just make it easy on yourself. I didn't make it easy on myself.
Well, we learn much more from the things that don't go as expected than we do from the things that are easy. I'll always ask, people say all kinds of nice things during our events, but I'm much more interested in what didn't go well than I am in what did. Let me ask you, as we start to wrap, I'm going to ask you a question that just on instinct, I think you will get what I'm saying in the most non-arrogant way. Somewhere along the journey, there's a gear that clicks in, and I'm going to use the word confidence, where you sort of know that you know what you're doing. And it's no longer, can I do this? I don't know, but you know you can. And then it's putting the right team, the right plan together against that. Talk about that evolution of that non-arrogant confidence, which just on instinct, I sense that you have.
Yeah, I mean, when you say it clicks in, I think I'm quite down to earth in that I am always open to learning. I think there are certain areas that I'm instinctively incredibly confident in. So, obviously advising on PR, incredibly confident. I am still very unconfident in lots of areas of business. I'd say unconfident. I think I like to have input. So I will still talk to people and say, please give me your opinion. And I'm a real person that will search for opinion. I like to hear best practice. But yeah, I think it probably took me about, I want to say 7 years of running a business until I thought, yeah, I can do this. I can actually do it. This is not me just making it up, because it felt like I was making it up every single day. I won a really big award in 2015 in New York, actually. It was a global award, and it was the two award it was two awards actually, and it's like my favorite photograph in my entire life, and it was a real turning point for my confidence. And the awards were Entrepreneur of the Year and Fastest Growing Business of the Year. And I turned up at this event, I'd been invited, and there were loads of people from all over the world there, and I sat at the table and they came to my category. And what I'd seen around me is if there were international people, they basically read you out as third place, then they'd go through second, and then they'd describe the winner. They read for first third place, sorry, and second, and I wasn't in it. And I turned around to my husband and said, they must have not got my registration. Like that honestly, I was that surprised where they then went out to read that I'd won. I literally was like, I've like me, never won. I've never won a tombola. I've never won a darts match, any kind of match, Gymkhana, nothing, no races at school. It was the first thing I'd ever won 5 years into the business. And it was such a testament, I think, to the struggle that I'd had two very young children, making it up, hugely fast growing business. We were the fastest growing business in Europe at that time in the PR space. So it was just going so fast before my eyes. But it was that moment when I thought, okay, we've got external recognition now. So I would say it hasn't clicked in, but you're right. I am quietly confident in many, many areas, but I still want to learn more. I'm still hungry for more. You need to tell me how you're doing multiple businesses so that I can set up something else.
I love this story, and it's easy to see how Ginger May has done so well, not only attracting clients, but keeping them. And I think it all starts with you. And this has been an absolutely joyful conversation. It's the first time we've had a chance to really talk in some detail other than a drive-by, a little smile and a handshake. And I loved having you here on Great Minds. So thank you so much for doing this, Victoria.
Thanks, Matt. It's been an absolute pleasure and lots of fun, like you promised it would be.
There you go. Cheers.
Take care.